The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
My name is Michael Guyon, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour, Martin Pelletier, who I've spoken to, I think, once or twice in the past, and this will be a good conversation. So, Martin, for those who are not familiar with your background, and hopefully I pronounced your last name correctly, because I know what that's like with my last name, Guyon, just introduce yourself. Who are you? How'd you get involved in markets, and how's Canada?
Perfect. Thank you for having me on your show here. My background is a little dynamic. I started off in investment banking. I was a highly ranked energy analyst working for some boutique investment banks during the bull commodity run from 2000 through to 2014. I did pull the ripcord in Calgary Stampede of July of 2008 before the big meltdown. So that's why I still have longer hair. And it still exists. And then I transitioned into the buy side by partnering with a colleague and a former client who used to be a fund manager and headed up the private client group at a $50 billion firm called Moore here in Calgary. And then we built up a private client, a high net worth family office practice with some investment pools. And at one time we did have an energy fund as well, and have done that since and sold our firm, merged into Wellington Altus Private Counsel to become the foundation of the private counsel practice about 2.5 years ago. And that's it.
So I have to give you you a lot of credit, Martin. So I was watching an interview you did around 11 months ago or so, and you had this whole thesis around inflation being higher than people thought it would be at the time. And that commodities, energy was the way to go and to largely avoid tech. And you had said that that was a non-consensus call, which obviously ended up turning out to be quite right. Now, I've had a lot of people on these spaces talk about the commodity segment of the investment landscape. I've had Eric Nuttall on one of these spaces as well, talking about oil. And a lot of people are still of the mindset that commodities are going to have a secular move, that this move is not yet over. I'm curious if anything has changed from 11 months ago when you first brought up that thesis. Are things likely to continue? Do you think that things have petered out? And how do you think about that all in the construct of asset allocation?
So many ways to address that, but I think some context would be important before I get to it. Just because I was an energy analyst doesn't mean I'm a perma bull in the energy sector. And so we did run an energy hedge fund. And when OPEC positioned themselves back in 2014, going after U.S. shale producers, we made the decision to shut down that fund. It was just too difficult to tell people to buy energy when you didn't believe that it was the right time to buy energy. And so when you're running a fund, it tends to put some pressure on you in regards to making decisions and buy and sell decisions. So we try to be agnostic as much as possible. And another great example of this we had a big client that he did not like bonds at all. And it took us 6-7 months to convince him to go to buy bonds, not only buy bonds, but buy 20 plus year treasuries as a defensive mechanism. And that really helped our portfolios in March of 2020 as that position rallied 45%. And that was a 15% weighting. So when we make calls, it's not a huge binary call, but that 15% weighting resulted in some material downside protection during that COVID situation. Now, following that, we had to have the conversation of why you don't want to own bonds, and certainly not 20-year bonds, and why you want to own energy. And so we took our energy weighting from, 2 or 3% a year and a half ago, back to 15%. And some of that's been due to gains in the sector as well. And we don't have any of those 20-year treasuries. And so I think it's important to relay that on to listeners that, we're not a perma believer in any sort of themes. So for example, you have a lot of people out there that are long duration in technology, and this is the new future, and we're going to disrupt all kinds of segments of the economy, including commodities and labor and everything else. And I'm just not a believer in those kinds of extreme situations. Now, looking ahead where we are right now, now that you've got some context on my background and some of the positioning and trading that we've done, I believe that we're 1 year or a year and a half into a 12-year commodity cycle. And it's been the commodity sector has been highly ignored and underinvested in over the last decade. And having worked in that particular field, I understand the importance of capital in regards to resource development and maintaining a readily available supply side. And so because of that underinvestment, which was only accelerated due to COVID and the price, significant price drop, and it's only getting worse with commodity volatility. We're having commodity prices move significantly, plus or minus 40% in a year. And as business owners, when you have your underlying and your price taker and your underlying commodity moves that much, you tend to be in a holding pattern, and you certainly don't put capital back in the ground. And so I'm very bullish. I think that the next 10 years is going to be, if you don't have an energy exposure within your portfolio, you're going to be significantly underperforming your peers.
Okay, so you said 12 years, I believe. Why the number 12? I'm just curious.
Well, typically commodity cycles, when you look at them, they tend to move in sort of a decade type of range. If you look at previous commodity cycles in itself, for how long they last from a duration standpoint, they tend to last 10 to 15 years. So I'm kind of picking the middle there. And capital doesn't come in until you're, if you look at those past cycles, capital doesn't come in until year three or four. And so you just don't have the believers in it until it establishes itself. And so like any sort of resource in any sort of new product development or anything, you have the early believers, but you don't have people buying in until it shows itself being sustainable. So, yeah, there's probably some benefit to waiting a little bit before it establishes itself. But I think there'll be a lot of volatility and lots of chances to participate in that.
So I think this is an important point. And I always use this line on Twitter and in conversations that path matters more than prediction, right? When it comes to managing a portfolio, the sequence of returns is what drives everything, not so much the endpoint. So research or analysts have to focus on the endpoint being right. Portfolio managers have to focus on the way that you get to the endpoint. And you mentioned volatility when it comes to the commodity space. So I think from my vantage point, when I hear people talk about commodities, talk about energy and oil, there seems to be this conviction that it's going to print money in an unrelenting way. But you can obviously, to your point about volatility, have years within that secular cycle where it's underperforming or losing money and then maybe has a big catch up and overtakes it. So how do you think about the volatility of commodities as an asset class and from a sector positioning? How do you manage that sequence of returns within the context of the endpoint that you're expecting we're going to get to?
Awesome question. And there's different ways you can do that. Within the sector itself, you can play the volatility through either the stocks or the commodity themselves. And so in today's environment, for example, more recently, you're having the stocks outperform the commodity just on a short couple of weeks here, backing it up and you expanding it, spending a time horizon, the commodities have outperformed the equities. And so you can actually buy, for a great way of looking at it, simplistic terms, is that if you believe in longer term oil prices, for example, you believe that oil prices in this kind of environment, even a mild recessionary type of environment, that oil prices can sustain a $75 to $80 a barrel, you know, price. If that is your viewpoint, you can buy that barrel in the futures market, or you can buy the barrel through an equity. And so the implied valuation of oil, of a barrel of oil through a company right now, despite the outperformance in the last couple of weeks, is $50 a barrel. And so these companies are not putting money back into the ground. They're buying back their barrels at $50. And so, you know, that's something that we may want to look at as an investor. And yes, there's going to be some volatility in there. So you can manage that equity volatility. By example, you know, June had a major sell-off in the sector by 30% off of their highs. You know, I know that you do some chart work. There are others who do that as well too. You know, you can pick your spots by, you know, looking at those as being opportunities in that longer term cyclical bull.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyett here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Okay, now again, this is I'm talking more from a portfolio management perspective, because one can have a thesis, but I always make that point that what you own matters a lot less than how much you own of it, right? So when you think about having, you know, a multi-year thesis like you do, and you think about being CIO, managing portfolios, how do you manage weightings, again, in the context of that sequence, in the context of that volatility? Because, you know, we all know that the more volatile an investment is, yes, potentially the more return, but also the more likely your clients might bomb out at the exact wrong time.
So one of the commodity funds that we invest in is actually quite interesting. It's different than what you see from CTA or from some of the other commodity funds. They look at it from a volatility contribution. And so, for example, an energy you would think would be a very high weighting, but due to its significant level of volatility contribution into that portfolio, they adjust their weighting down. And so I think the same approach can be done within a broader portfolio as well. And so you can have a 10 or 15% weighting longer term in the energy sector and have that, you know, going above that would be very challenging, especially looking at the level of volatility within that particular sector that you're owning. So having those weightings, understanding the volatility contribution within the portfolios is important as a portfolio manager.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to think about it. Of course, the assumption there is that just like the old adage, past performance is not indicative of future results, the also adage that comes from that is past volatility is not indicative of maybe future volatility as well, which we can touch on. But something I've been thinking about in the context of this broader secular cycle, which I've said many times I agree with. It's funny because I had some people on FinTwit seem to want to argue with me about the sequence of energy price returns when I saw sentiment be so one-sided for a moment in time, mid-June, basically making a quasi-bearish case. But I do wonder, is it possible to have commodities, and in particular the energy sector, have a multi-year secular period of outperformance while tech is doing the same? And I only say that because when you think from a sector perspective, I can make a case that the two are pretty much on the exact opposite ends of the asset allocation spectrum. Tech underperforms, like the energy outperforms, and vice versa. But can you have a period where the two are sort of in the top performing areas of the equity space?
Yeah, why not? I mean, you can have, for the longest time, people said bonds are going to do the, you know, do the opposite of what equities are. And look what happened to balance 60-40 portfolios this year. So yes, you can have periods that, that they will move together. And that's important to understand because we've been increasing some of the duration of components of the portfolio or adding in some of the tech, looking at cash flows and adding in some Microsoft and Amazon and Google within the portfolios. At the same time, we're buying energy. And so it's important that our clients understand that, that it's not a black or white binary situation. We're looking at the risk contribution of each component within that portfolio. And yeah, there's times that they can, the correlations can become unwound. And so you have to understand what would be the catalyst for that and why that would happen. And you, you know, a lot of it can be, you know, driven around monetary policy, some of it not. And so, yeah, I think you bring up an excellent point.
So I'm curious, Martin, you've been at this game for a while. And I think there's this interesting impression by people that are not in the industry that think that when you're a portfolio manager, you have to be doing something every single second of the day related to analysis or trading or portfolio management. I'm asking this question purposely because I've seen some people make the case that if you're managing money and you're in a drawdown, well, then you should spend more time managing money. I want you to talk about your day-to-day activities. As somebody who's in the business, somebody who's dealing with a large firm and dealing with asset allocation, how much time is spent towards analysis, reassessing portfolio positions versus other activities that are still important for the business but may not be exactly directly related to it?
Oh, well, my days can be dynamic. And the nice thing about running a smaller practice versus a very large asset manager is that we have a lot of flexibility and we can be dynamic in our day-to-day. And so if something comes up that warrants some attention, then you can dictate your time towards that. I look at everything from an ROI perspective. I look at my return on investment and I look at my ROI of my time and where am I best able to add value to our clients. And so in some cases, when the markets are doing some silly things and they create opportunities, it's a very high ROI time. And there's periods that it's not doing as much. And sometimes the best trade is the one you don't do. You're not just doing something to stay busy. And so you can reallocate that time towards other areas outside of the market. For example, we do a lot of tax and estate work with clients and moving the investments around that work that we're doing. And so it can be quite dynamic and having that flexibility is very important. And your last point about drawdowns and I think that's going to be, that's my bull thesis for the second half of this year. I think that a lot of asset managers are facing career risk. And the last thing they want to do is get defensive and not capture the upside return in the market should this rally have legs and continue. They basically have locked in some losses or not participating to that upside. So I think there's going to be a lot of capital going into the market chasing this rally higher going into the fall here. So understanding the emotional aspect of the impact on the market is also equally important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm only trying to tease that question out because based, which means it has nothing to do with my opinion or even my own analysis. I'm simply following what the rules are saying as the architect of the approach. When you do that, you have time, right? You can do things. And when you're in this business from a portfolio management perspective and you're dealing with clients and individuals, especially when you're in a drawdown, a lot of your time is spent communicating, right? Because if your thesis hasn't changed, drawdowns will happen, whether it's buy and hold or tactical or whatever it be, or thematic. But if you want, to your point about career risk, right, the activity is in the communication, right? And I think that's what's perhaps missed by a lot of the FinTwit community that doesn't know how the industry itself works.
Yeah, if you're a sector-focused fund manager, absolutely, the communication is essential. Whereas we're broader-based, and we focus on something called goals-based benchmarking. So what I mean by that is we focus on generating a specific rate of return to a client, designing a portfolio around that, and minimizing the portfolio volatility. And so, for example, with our situation, we're running a tactical balance strategy that's only down, 1.5%, 2% this year, whereas a lot of our peers are down 12, 13%. So we don't have to have those kinds of conversations. And, last year prior, when the market, our peers were up 15 or 16%, we're only up 12.5%. So you net the two ahead, we're well ahead then of our peers. So our clients didn't call us. We didn't have to communicate due to the underperformance last year. And we certainly don't have to have those kinds of conversations this year. Actually, we're having the kind of conversations where it's time to put some risk on the table and use some of that downside protection that we were able to provide and do the upside capture. Whereas if you have a specific sector specific, like if you're running energy fund, for example, and June hits and you're down, 20 or 30%, whatever the number is, but you're still up net ahead this year, 20%, whatever that number is, you have to relay that volatility expectation to those clients. And sure, you're going to lose some who give into things like performance chasing and loss aversion, all of those traditional emotional aspects. And so that's where that communication plays a much higher role, in our opinion, is when you're running something, more specific like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm kind of speaking from my vantage point. A lot of my time is spent trying to communicate and suggest to people to read the prospectus and actually look at the indices that track against to understand, at least in theory, how these approaches would have worked. But unless you are actively out there doing that, well, what else are you doing during the day? Again, if you have the thesis, you're not going to actively do anything, in terms of your portfolio second by second, right? So I think that's an important consideration when it comes to thinking about investing. Now, I want to go to the name of the space and the point about goals-based investing, because if we agree that volatility is elevated everywhere, then it's not just a minefield for the stock market, it's a minefield for every single place you put capital risk, right? And the big surprise minefield was, as we've seen, treasuries, which I would distinguish separately from bonds in high volatility drawdowns for equities. Let's, talking from a portfolio manager perspective, when you're in these periods where drawdowns are correlated, with the exception of commodities, at least so far, how do you manage from the goals-based perspective that you bring to the table? How do you think about goals-based investing in the context of periods where diversification isn't really helping very much?
Well, there are pockets that can help. And so having, again, the only sector that was positive this year, the only area that was positive, well, two areas, U.S. dollars and energy, which we happen to have a lot of both, and especially for Canadian investors, and that's a whole separate topic. But looking at the relationship and the thesis, thankfully, that was able to help us significantly. Are we underperforming? Did we didn't meet our goals-based objectives this year, but last year and the last 5 years, despite some big drawdowns in the markets, we have met most, if not all, of our goals-based objectives for clients, simply because we're willing to be agnostic with our views. So it's not as rules based as a quant based model, and that's given us that flexibility to go to areas that sometimes can be ignored. And so in this year's market, we had energy that helped a lot. We had U.S. dollars, which helped a lot, but not huge compared to other currencies. We're underweight EFI markets. I'm not a fan at all of what's happening in Europe and the Far East and Japan. And so we took our weightings down in January to zero. So that really helped on the downside protection, especially on currencies. And then we've also have a large weighting in, we do something called custom build. We go to capital markets and we build. We used to be big option traders. And so we understand the value of utilizing options within portfolios to help manage that volatility. And so good portfolio managers will be able to do that and utilize options in all markets, especially volatile markets like the ones we're witnessing. And so we do some structured notes utilizing options. And those structured notes have been outstanding for us. And, we're up to about 25 to 30% weighting in these option-derived structured notes that that have provided material downside and offering yields of, you know, 8 to 12%. And so those are all that combined is really helping us protect that downside. And you know, we're thinking that we're going to be heading into recovery here. So we've been reducing some of those positions and going more long into, especially even some of the tech, like the big tech.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
All right, so you mentioned currencies, which is interesting. So I'm looking at, just as a proxy as we're speaking, the FXC Canada Dollar Trust ETF. And, you know, dollar's been very strong. The Canadian dollar has not really dropped that much, yep. Certainly, obviously, relative to the euro. But I, given, the, you know, from your vantage point in Canada, how do you think about this dollar strength? And you kind of alluded to this idea that it's important for your own clients to have exposure to U.S. dollars, but there is historically a pretty tight link between the Canadian, right, the loonie and the dollar. So talk about that dynamic a little bit.
So, you know, the Canadian dollar will never be at par with the U.S. dollar. This nuke out, take out the commodity complex. We just don't have the same kind of productivity that the U.S. does have. We're severely lacking. In addition, our economy has shifted heavily towards non-producing assets like real estate, and that's been the primary driver of our economic growth, and so you put that combined, it's providing an outlook that's actually bearish on the Canadian dollar, and it actually hasn't performed very well. I mean, yes, compared to other currencies, yes, it has a stronger relationship with the U.S. because of the trade. But with oil prices, given its historical relationship with oil prices, the Canadian dollar should be much higher than where it is right now and is delinked from its move from commodity prices.
Explain that, because that's interesting. I haven't heard that before. So what is the link between the Canadian currency side and the commodity side? Exactly. Well, the transmission mechanism, so to speak.
Yeah, and so, for example, looking just simply because of the capital investment going into a high growth sector like energy, you had the Canadian dollar go above par in the commodity run from the oil run from 2000 through to past 2008 before the financial crisis, and then it went back again through to prior to 2014. And so, typically, a large component of our growth of this country's growth will come from expansionary efforts within oil sands and growth in output there. And that has a big driving factor on the Canadian dollar. And so these producers here in Canada get paid in U.S. dollars and their cost base is in Canadian dollars. But what's happened is that the government, the Trudeau government, has put severely restrictive policy in place, basically preventing any sort of expansion, both for LNG and domestic oil sands expansion growth. That's come in the form of Bill C-69, which is limited and will certainly prevent any further pipelines being built in this country. And so as a result, there's no room for growth. There's nobody going to put capital, investment capital. So a lot of the U.S. producers have left Canada. And that's only accelerated. And you can see that with a 35 or 30% vacancy rate in downtown Calgary among the high rises. You have one high rise that's, I think it's 30 or 40 floors. It's completely empty. And the Chinese have exited as well, too. And so as a result, you know, the currency is delinked from its historical relationship with oil. And that's not a good thing, especially when it comes to monetary policy. And the flexibility around what the Bank of Canada can do with interest rates. And so it's very important to understand that dynamic. Having said that, we're bearish on the Canadian economy, very bearish on the existing government and their policies. And at the same time, bullish on Canadian oil companies. I just told you, they're getting paid in U.S. dollars and their cost base is in Canadian dollars. And so as an investor, you're getting exposure to that U.S. currency.
Let's before I bring up Sahab here for a question, let's talk about real estate for a moment, because here in the States, we keep seeing these utterly insane charts around housing affordability in Canada. And I had Logan, his last name has escaped me, haven't slept very much, but for a space recently mentioned that in the case of Canada, that much of this kind of big moving Canadian market is really around just kind of two or three primary cities, and you don't really see it across Canada as a whole. Talk about the state of real estate for a moment in Canada, and if that's going to be potentially a potential crisis setup in the future.
Yeah, and so what's happened is that expansionary monetary policy and low rates. A lot of that in the U.S. after was a big reset in the financial crisis away from housing, and a lot of that capital went into actually quite favorable some innovation, high innovative projects, especially in the technology space. In Canada, that money went all real estate, and it went all in on real estate, and it became the next thing since sliced bread. And so you had markets like the Toronto and Vancouver, and then expanding out from those regions. For example, you have Hamilton, Ontario. Not to pick on Hamilton, it's a nice city, but now it's more expensive than San Jose, California. And I've been to both places, and San Jose, California certainly, you know, takes it on that one. And so you've had a huge speculative growth in that segment of the economy. And it's a non-producing asset. So once you put money into the house, it's not going to generate any future growth. And that's a concern of ours. And that trade is starting to become unwound in certainly in places like New Zealand and Australia that have experienced the same kind of relationship as Canada. And it hasn't as much so in Canada, but it's starting. And so that's going to have all kinds of implications. 15% weighting, what does that mean? If I look at the TSX and energy weighting and compare it to the S&P 500, the TSX, by having that kind of exposure, it significantly outperformed the S&P from 2000 through for that 10-year run. And then subsequent, it moved the U.S. Significantly outperformed Canada. And so when we're making calls as a portfolio manager, we try and manage risk accordingly. And Michael was saying, looking at the volatility contribution and looking at a weighting within a particular sector, it's important to understand what that's going to contribute. And so you don't need to have a huge weighting on a particular segment of to have a meaningful impact on return. And don't forget, we're not running a sector specific or an equity specific. We're just trying to generate a sufficient rate of return and minimize the risk possible to get there. And so we don't want to have a call that we could be wrong on blow up on us. And so, for example, I've read that every 1% increase in inflation, commodity prices move 8 to 9%. And so you don't need to have a huge weighting to add some inflation protection within the portfolio. You don't need to have a huge weighting to have meaningful outperformance compared to your peers. So sure, in hindsight, I would have loved to have a 30 or 40% weighting to energy this year. And in some clients, we'd run tactical portfolios, and we do. And that's what their goal is, to target a very high level of return. So the mandate of weightings really depends on the clients. And most of our clients are conservative investors trying to get 6 to 8, and having a 10 or 15% weighting is probably at the higher end for those clients targeting a 6 to 8% rate of return consistently. And so we don't need to go any higher than that.
Let me add to that, because I think this is part of the issue with perception versus reality when it comes to FinTwit based on one's profession. So you're a portfolio manager, I'm a portfolio manager. We have mandates. We have certain bands through which we have to do things based on some thesis around energy, suddenly change the composition because the way the strategies are constructed is literally, you know, a legal document, right? So I can't go get away from that. Same deal with any portfolio manager. You have to consider the risk tolerance of your own clients. And you can have volatile investments that can be phenomenal from a longer-term perspective and have a real belief in a particular investment thesis, But if you've got an 80-year-old widow who's a client, you can be as excited as you want about energy and say it should be 50% of the portfolio. But this goes back to my point about path versus prediction. What if you happen to put that money to work in June, right? What then happens to that 80-year-old who needs that capital? So I think, you know, it's there are other considerations, and you kind of expand on this part a little bit. There are other considerations beyond just here's an investment idea that I really believe in practice when you're managing money for other people.
Absolutely. I mean, you answered the question better than me. Like you could play different derivatives of it. So for example, we've done for the more conservative investor, we did a structured note on the XOP, which is US producers, and it's going to pay our clients 15% yield paid monthly, annualized 15%, as long as the XOP doesn't fall more than 40%, or I think it's 30 or 40% from current levels, which has already been down from June. And so we look at that in itself as looking to be an excellent trade. Now, you know, XOP rallies 30 or 40%, who really cares? We're getting our 15%. We're not trying to beat a particular benchmark, because if you do that, you're putting yourself at risk from a benchmark perspective. And you end up performance chasing. So if you look at investors, why didn't you go all US equities the last 10 years? Why did you have any European exposure? Why did you have any Canadian exposure? And that may not be the right call for the next 10 years. And so that's the risk about going into an all or nothing position within, or a heavily overweight call on a particular sector. There are managers that do that. We're just not one of them. Two good questions on the currency. I think the currency is probably dead money to down on the CAD. The US dollars against other currencies has had a really strong move, and that there could be some changes there, some profit taking. But overall, our outlook is neutral to bearish on the Canadian dollar. I don't think there's huge downside to it, simply because of Michael mentioned a relationship with the US and trade with the US. Simply by being situated next to the US, it certainly provides a backstop to our currency. And so I'm not super bearish. I'm not super bullish. I'm not bullish at all. And I'm more neutral to slightly bearish. Looking at our positioning, we're run about 40 to 50% of our client, all of our clients. We have one US client or two US clients down in Houston, but that's separate. Looking, majority of our clients are if not all, are Canadian. And we have to have some Canadian exposure. And so for them, we're running about a 40 to 50% weighting in US denominated assets, again, which has also been very beneficial. And should we, that's been longer term like that. And should something happen with the Canadian dollar, that it maybe by some magic happens and the government has a come to Jesus and they want to develop resources, then maybe we change our outlook and change our weightings. Now on housing and the Canadian banks, I think if you look at Home Capital and what happened a number of years ago, they got bailed out by the federal government with Morneau. And from what I've heard, and the interaction with Buffett coming in and helping support that, I think the Canadian banks are very well buffered against a housing correction in Canada, simply because they've offloaded a lot of their more speculative debt. And a lot of that speculative debt has gone into the shadow banking market, which now is almost the same size as the Canadian banking market. And so looking back at the Home Capital example, it was very important that I call the bank cartel have a strong shadow banking market to offload that debt. And a great example of it is there's been such rapid appreciation in those markets. And so if you have a homeowner that has $1 million of debt against a house that's now worth $2 million, and the bank's loaned on that, and they don't have the income requirements to meet rising rates, especially if it's floating, the bank doesn't care. The probability of that going back to $1 million is probably ultra low. So the bank's going to be very well protected. Whereas if you have a shadow banking lender and and the loan to value is different, you know, it's now 1.75 on 2 million, that could easily go underwater. And so I would be careful about the shadow banking, you know, and exposure to that. I'd be careful on mortgage investment corps and make sure you do your diligence on what you own within those sectors, because there could be some blow ups in those areas of the market. Okay, it's two things. One is, it seems, you know, you've got a certain viewpoint and looking around the timing around that. And what happens, the big question is, if you don't get the timing right and there isn't a financial crisis and these things don't sell off and they continue to move higher and you've missed the trade, it's always good to ask, how am I wrong? How could I be wrong? And what would be the impact? And I've spent a significant amount of time looking at the risks of a potential financial crisis, because that would have a material impact on oil prices, as what we saw in March of 2020. And I'm just not a believer in that for a number of different reasons. Looking at participating within the segment, having a good active manager, you know, Eric Nuttall does a really good job. So you can buy units within his fund. It recognizing that there will be that volatility and recognizing that he's going to always be more bullish than other people like me. But you know, he knows how to pick good stocks within that segment. He used to be a client of mine. So, I know I'm going back to the Sprott days. There's other managers out there where you can simply put together an ETF portfolio. XEG is pretty good here in Canada. The XOP is good in the US. I'd stay away from the levered ones, because for a number of different reasons. And now I just manage your weightings accordingly, and you'll do just fine.
By the way, you said something which I think is important, and you mentioned leverage and some of these leverage funds that have the daily reset. So people don't really, I think, really fully understand the link between volatility in an asset class and daily reset of leverage in the asset class. Right? I've written a paper that won the 2016 Dow Award on this point: how do you manage leverage for the long run? The reason why leverage doesn't work with highly volatile assets is because you re-lever at the exact wrong time. So you, if something is up big a particular day, now you're 2x. Well, then the day after, then it goes down big, you're still 2x, but now you're re-levering on a smaller base. So what happens is, they call it the constant leverage trap. When you have high volatility and daily reset of leverage, it actually gets you very suboptimal returns.
Yeah.
Over time, even though it sounds like, oh well, if it's going up, you should be levered on that. It goes back to path and sequence, not prediction. So, if you will believe me that volatility is the enemy of leverage, then the only question then is, well, how do you identify volatile regimes? That's when you'd want to think about leverage. But for most people, you don't want to touch that at all.
And I 100% I agree, and thank you for explaining, touching on that. The other aspect too is these commodity ETFs and understanding backwardation versus contango, and what does that mean on the roll and forward curve. And people found out the hard way at the USO 2 years ago, and so now, you know, you're benefiting from the roll because of the steep backwardation, but doing some research work and understanding that can be, you know, is very important. And there are some commodity managers out there. I'm a huge fan of Pierre Andrand in France. He's just been brilliant. And I do not invest in his fund, but I have a friend who runs a family office in the Caymans that does, and put me onto him 7 years ago. So there are some good commodity managers. He was actually shorting the USO when prices went negative on that role. So having a professional manage your commodity exposure is can be very beneficial.
Yeah, and I'm talking a little bit just from my own vantage point on leverage point, only because I shared it in the Nest to sort of get an understanding of the link between leverage and volatility.
Okay, so top three sectors, 24 months. Energy, absolutely, I'd have exposure there. I also like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple. I think that they'll do well. I think there's a lot of momentum in that space. And I'm looking at other areas for the third spot. That one, I'm still doing some more research, but the fertilizer egg space looks really interesting because it's come off hard here. That in particular, especially given some of the positioning around global fertilizer restrictions, may be overdone, but I'm a contrarian by heart. So I tend to want to do the opposite of what everybody else does, and that can get me into trouble. So I've tempered my approach to that with being a little more cautious. but it certainly can lead to some strong gains. And so I'm looking at the egg space right now as a next potential area to expand into.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that as well. So I appreciate the appreciation. My own spaces. But the okay. So I want to go back to this point about communicating with clients, right? And having your own investment thesis. Now, again, as a especially when you manage separately managed accounts, you know, you're supposed to have full say over the management of your clients' accounts, but you and I both know when you're managing separately managed accounts, you're managing individuals, it's their money. So if they don't want you to do something, you've got to, at the end of the day, really listen to them or fire them as a client. I'm curious, Martin, if you've had any pushback from any of your own clients that have seen this move towards energy, have seen you being right, and are maybe saying, well, maybe we should take some chips off the table. What's your response communication-wise to your own clients that might be a little nervous?
We're very careful. We only have 50 households that we're managing. So we know our clients very well. We're very careful about the clients that we take on. We go through a mutual interview process. And sometimes, again, the hardest thing you can do is say no to a very large client if there isn't a big fit between your approach and style and their perception and their viewpoints. We did that once, and we learned heavily from that, and we promised ourselves we would never go down that same path. And so the majority of our clients, you know, we have regular and consistent communication from the outset. For a very large client, for example, we'll do a weekly update as we're placing their money into the market and why we're doing it, so they get an understanding of our process and our strategy and why we're doing what we're doing. And then eventually that expands out to quarterly and then maybe semi-annual. And so the more frequency of that communication on the onset to get the understanding and the buy-in, the greater the trust in handing it over on those business decisions. And we can do that because we have two portfolio managers on 50 households, and a lot of advisors can't, or even portfolio managers can't do that. And if you're running a portfolio with hundreds of thousands of unit holders, then how do you do that? And I think regular and consistent communication is probably the best course of action.
Yeah, so it always goes back to communicate.
Yeah,
which is where, you know, spaces and Twitter, you know, can be helpful. Of course, you know, the problem is people think that you're self-promoting when in reality you're just simply trying to do what any business owner should do, which is try to make sure people understand why things are happening the way that they're happening to the best of your own interpretation and have integrity in communicating that.
Right? Now, I'll jump in on that, Michael.
Yeah,
that it's very, 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 I said it three times, important that what you're talking about publicly is being reflected within their portfolio.
100%. And that's another thing. Well, let's go with that. I'm glad you can go.
So many people get that wrong. And you know, there's some prolific managers out there that I know in social media. They're on the news or on Twitter and they're talking about this stock or talking about this segment of the market. The client opens up their portfolio and it's not in there. And so you absolutely have to have consistency in your messaging, but it also has to be reflected in the bottom line.
And it has to be honest, right? Because to your point, if you actually go and look at the portfolio, they end up not having it. So skin in the game is the ultimate way of aligning incentives and making sure that one is being honest. Now, again, talking from experience, I've tried my best, although people seemingly still don't fully understand the point that, and part of that honesty is not just in terms of look at this position that did well or this time when a particular strategy really outperformed. It was also about explaining when you're in the drawdowns what's happening, right? I mean, I think the other part of this point about communication is that too often people will pound their chest and be very loud when they're on a hell of a run in their own portfolios, but then you hear nothing from them when they're in a decline, right? And to me, as somebody who's trying to at least visibly and verbally show integrity and be very open and honest, that's frustrating to me because I'm trying to communicate, trying to get people to understand and showing data to get to the point, but everybody else is talking about, well, look how great I did with energy. And God bless that they did, right?
Yeah.
But it's I think it makes for a very toxic environment in some ways if you only focus on the good, just like you'd only focus on the bad.
But owning it too, right? And that's important is, like, especially among sophisticated investors, you do your research, you understand what the philosophy is and what the strategy is. And then if that particular segment is underperforming, the great example is like value versus growth. And, you know, if you look at a value manager, they significantly underperform. But if you look at versus growth, but some value managers outperform that value segment of that market, and understanding that and understanding the reasons why. And if you're honest with people, especially individuals who are sophisticated enough to understand that there are times that relationships break down, and there are times that can have an impact on a certain portfolio. I think if you're honest with them and you provide comfort in the forward in some future guidance as to why that theory or that thesis still holds, then I think you might be surprised with the patience that comes with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. I think that's, again, this is talking from the standpoint of two people that are in the industry and are in the arena managing money for others, right? Which, again, I always make this point, managing the business side of investing is very different than managing investments.
Yeah. And so, you know, we had a client that we had fired, and, you know, they were looking at the individual holdings and why aren't they all up? And when you're looking at portfolio construction, you know, you have to have things behave and perform differently within the portfolio to get you to that goals-based target. And so having understanding around that is important.
Yeah, I've used that line before that, you know, you're not diversified unless you have parts of your portfolio that you hate.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're going to naturally hate the things which you're not doing well, which maybe we argue.
Well, yeah, I own some gold for the first time. And so, you know, that has not been a good call. For the first time I bought some gold. And so do I still, you know, my thesis still remains intact, but, you know, but that's okay. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's just because it's not working now doesn't mean it won't work later. I think also the problem that people forget is that it's always ever changing, right? You can make any argument based on your start and end date, right? Which is always the dilemma also from a communication perspective and in terms of thinking about investment.
Philosophically, I'm always for dividends. And it goes back to my iBanking days when I was on the sell side, but I was an analyst. And I used to get in big fights with my investment bankers because whether you should do a stock deal or a cash deal. And they kept talking psychologically about the cash side. The doing a stock deal because you get the upside carried forward in the other company. And I love cash. I love liquidity. I love cash. And I love dividends instead of buybacks. Dividends, give me my money. If I want to decide to put more money back into your company, I can do that, or I can buy another company. So give me the more options that I have, the better. Whereas you're making a decision for me in a buyback. And so I've always loved cash deals, and I've always liked dividends over buybacks. And maybe that's just old school, but I find it served me well.
By the way, that should be a conversation for another space, because I've always had this belief that one way you can solve the overtraining dynamic and maybe level the playing field more between the real wealth gap, which is between corporations and individuals, is to mandate to some degree, which may not be a popular thing, but mandate dividends over to buybacks or over anything else, right?
Because yeah.
Paying the shareholders, there's all kinds of other positive benefits as opposed to just having it stay in the company. In terms of broader society, I would argue.
And watch for my financial piece next week that I'm writing about. I'm actually making the argument against central bankers that wage inflation is a good thing. It'll reduce income inequality. It will result in higher productivity. And it will result in a lessening of geopolitical polarization. And so, who'd have thought that higher wages can be good for everybody?
Few understand this. Everyone, again, please make sure for sure you follow Martin. Very, very interesting conversation here. And everybody, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you, Martin. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you, everybody. Cheers.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.